he muttered casually, as he slid his hands into his pockets in bored fashion and turned away to gaze out the window.
"Coming here was smart, I'll give you that. It's probably the last thing your enemy would expect you to do, jump from the frying pan into the fire. But that is where your wisdom ends."
His tone sharpened now.
"You drained her nearly dry, Caliban. The last time you did that to a female fae was during your inauguration, 15,000 years ago.
Caliban looked down at his fingernails, turning them over in nonchalance.
"It was 10,000 years ago, and again, what of it?"
"Unlike the last time, which amounted to simple overindulgence by someone who hadn't yet had enough practice, you did this one very much on purpose."
Caliban felt a spike of fury, which he expertly tamped down as he turned to pin Drummer with hard eyes.
"You're right,"
he said simply, crossing his arms over his chest.
"I did it on purpose."
He shrugged.
"I had my reasons."
"Oh, I just bet you did."
Drummer laughed mirthlessly.
"You were injured. You were being hounded by an enemy you couldn't identify, and you'd been uncomfortably drained by black diamonds and parasitic magic. And that wasn't all,"
he continued as he tilted his aged head to the side and narrowed his gaze.
"You suddenly found yourself faced with a woman who was more powerful than you, which in and of itself was a first. But she could have restored you to full strength and then some, and in a most pleasing manner, I might imagine."
He smiled winsomely for a split second, and then his serious expression was back.
"Except that for the first time in your long life, you weren't entirely certain you could charm the pants off someone."
He paused, no doubt for effect.
"This particular female is different, and that scares you."
Caliban shifted uncomfortably. He didn't like it when Drummer hit the nail so squarely on the head. He didn't say anything, not bothering to deny his advisor's words. But he could feel a flame entering his eyes. They were heating up with emotion and power. It was always a little painful when they did.
"Hence, when you saw Minerva release magic from a ruby, you seized the opportunity and somehow persuaded her to do the same with countless other rubies, filling you up with magic that wasn't yours, just as you would have done if you'd taken the young Wisher to your bed."
It was a bit ironic, that last bit, seeing as how the young Wisher was in his bed at that very minute. But the message was relayed loud and clear.
"She didn't take much persuading," he insisted in defense. "The girl is determined to prove her capabilities. I needed only to challenge her."
Drummer considered that in silence, but his eyes still glared. He was waiting for Caliban to admit his cruelties.
"What of it?"
There was an edge to his tone when Caliban asked the question for the third time. It was his right as king to take magic when and from whom he wanted. In this case, it was not only his right, it was necessary. He was in danger, as was his queen. Besides, he was the unseelie king. Expert manipulation was par for his course.
"She doesn't even know she's your queen, does she?"
The question came softly, but it sliced through his consciousness like a well-sharpened blade. He dropped his arms, uncrossing them from his chest. And all at once, and quite suddenly, he felt overwhelmed. He ran his hand over his face, feeling the heat of his skin as if he had a fever.
"There hasn't been time to tell her."
Drummer made a derisive sound.
"What are you waiting for, Caliban? Violinists and a rose garden? You're both running for your lives. You'd best tell her while you have the chance."
Caliban pulled his gaze from the old Doo-Wom Fae and glanced at the window, beyond which lay his beautiful, terrible lands. There was a pain in his chest when he looked at them now,
a kind of emptiness. He couldn't peer over his realm any longer without experiencing its piggybacking yearning to rule over said realm with his fated queen. The woman with hair like the full moon, and eyes like the dark. The woman who waited for him now in his bed. Only Minerva could fill that emptiness and stop that yearning from yawning completely open and ripping him in two from the inside out. Drummer was right. He needed to tell her. For whatever reason, the Fates had deemed it proper to magically educate Minerva on everything having to do with the Fey Realms, except perhaps the single most important part. She was a Fey Realm queen. His queen. He'd been a fool to wait as long as he had. Caliban sighed and said something he rarely said to anyone. "You're right." He moved away from the window, made his way to the large hearth that crackled invitingly across the study. It was time to do a lot of filling in. Before he confronted Minerva, he needed to make contact with his brother and let him know how things were progressing. And there was only one way he could think of doing so without unwittingly informing his enemy, whoever that was. "Pi, are you there?" he asked softly, as he braced his arms on the hearth and leaned closer to the flickering flames. Pi was a fire elemental who had taken it upon himself to serve the Goblin King, Daemon Croy. Over the years, his enthusiasm and loyalty had become rather contagious for the other Fey Kings, and now Pi was allowed in any of their hearths. At the moment, Caliban was very much hoping the young elemental would be able to hear him through the layers of fire between him and wherever Pi happened to be residing at that moment. He waited a few beats, and was about to send out a second call for him when the fire suddenly danced, wavered a bit, and a taller red flame appeared at its center. A face appeared in that flame. The color switched to orange-yellow, and the face smiled.
"Hello, Your Majesty."
It crackle-garbled in its fire-elemental way. Caliban smiled back. "It's good to see you."
"Likewise."
"I was wondering whether you would take a message to Croy for me. He'll then need to relay it to my brother."
"No problem. Fire away."
He laughed at his own turn of phrase.
"Get it? Fire away."
He laughed again. Caliban glanced over his shoulder to find Drummer chuckling. He tried not to roll his eyes. A few minutes later, the full message had been relayed and repeated, just to make sure Pi got it all right. Then Caliban asked,
"What has transpired at the table of the 13 in my absence?"
Pi suddenly became very still, like a candle flame where there was no breeze. His expression turned somber.
"It isn't good,"
he said finally. Caliban straightened.
"Oh?"
Pi looked up with big yellow eyes.
"No, there's a traitor among you."
Chapter 13. Roman glanced up at the door, to the study, when the air in the room took on a signature of familiar magic. He nodded to his companions, alerting them to their soon-to-be guest, and then made his way around the table they'd been working on. He waited in the center of the room as the air flashed. A swirling portal opened, and a man stepped through. Wind in the room ruffled everyone's hair before the portal swirled shut, leaving the air once more still.
"Not that I'm not pleased to see you, Croy, but it's a rare visit we get from you,"
said Lalura Chantel, who peered at him through blue eyes from where she stood hunched over the spell table at one end of the room.
"Far too rare, if you ask me,"
she continued, flirting openly with the Goblin King as she often shamelessly did. Daemon grinned at her.
"I won't disagree."
He nodded respectfully, then turned to Roman, who waited patiently, as he always did.
"Am I an uncle yet?"
Roman asked bluntly, trying not to show how much he actually hoped the answer would be yes, and that three new Fey royalty babies would be the reason for Croy's visit. Because he knew it wasn't. He could sense it in the air and see it in the tightness around Damon's eyes.
"Any second now," Damon replied easily. "But that's not the reason I'm here."
"I know," thought Roman. Damon continued.
"I received word from Caliban. He and Minerva have been under constant attack since the murder of the Tristane couple. He was obviously unable to give many details about his whereabouts, especially once he was informed about the—"
He trailed off, glanced at Lalora, and shrugged. What he'd been about to say was, "traitor," Roman knew. But the word left a foul taste on the tongue, and Damon obviously cared not to give it voice.
"The good news is," said Roman, "we've narrowed down the leak."
"Oh?" Roman nodded and gestured to the table behind him. Damon followed him to it, and the men joined the others already waiting. Evelyn D'Angelo was there, as was Lalora Chantel. Imani Zareb was also present, as were Siobhan Ashdown and her husband, the Phantom King, Thanatos. Damon nodded to each of them in turn by way of greeting, then looked down at the objects on the table. A scrying bowl filled with water, a thin square wooden plank with symbols burned into its surface, numerous candles, a divining crystal, and a map were laid out before them. The map Damon would recognize. It was a partial map of the realms, displaying 14 of them in the only two-dimensional manner possible. 13 of the realms belonged to the 13 kings. The other belonged to the mortals of Earth. It was, of course, impossible to display these realms with any kind of accuracy, especially since so many of them were so elusive, intangible and without true dimension. Realms such as Shadow and Time had no meaning that human maps would be able to translate. However, this particular map needn't be accurate. Its use was solely in labeling. The divining crystals simply needed a place to point to, and that was how the magic worked.
"We've been able to determine that our particular Judas resides among the kings who have yet to find their queen," Roman said.
"It makes sense," said Siobhan. She shrugged. "I mean, I guess they're the ones who figure they have nothing to lose."
"And who might also feel that they have nothing to gain?"
said Lalura.
"If they have little faith that they will ever find their own queen," Roman said, "their motivation might be twofold. One in outright jealousy of those men who have found their mates, the other in good old-fashioned gain."
"You think someone is paying off one of the 13?
Croy asked disbelievingly. Roman could understand his skepticism, but magic didn't lie.
"There's no question," he said softly. "However, I highly doubt money is involved. None of the 13 would be motivated by financial riches in any way, shape, or form."
"What then?" asked Croy.
Roman took a deep breath.
"That's what we are attempting to determine now. We've exhausted our capabilities of narrowing the suspects down any further, hence we've decided to take a different route and figure out what the culprit's motive may be. If we can determine that, we'll be 10 steps closer to our defector."
"The only thing in the realms that any of those 7 men truly want is a queen of their own," Damon said bluntly. "And I can't imagine anyone figuring out a way to promise such a thing to one of them. Women don't work that way."
"No, we don't," said Evie with a shake of her head. Then she frowned. "But maybe it's not like that. Maybe the bad guys have some way of being able to tell where and when a queen will appear on the radar. Some method of determining the future. That might get a king's attention."
Roman raised a brow.
"You may be on to something."
"Gotta admit that would be a sweet carrot to dangle in front of them," said Thanatos. "It just might be the case that our enemies figured out a way to jump the gun on queen location."
Siobhan made a derisive sound and smiled, shaking her head.
"Somehow, that just sounds so base."
"I agree," said Evie.
You make it sound like we're something less than living, breathing beings.
Thanatos shrugged. Sorry, he admitted sheepishly. I spend most of my time with dead people.
Oh, sure, play the dead people card, Croy teased.
Imani Zareb, a powerful witch who'd apprenticed under Lalura, and who was leader of her coven, cleared her throat. She'd had yet to speak up during the conversation. Her attention had been on the table, as she'd been in the middle of casting a spell when Damon Croy arrived. She seemed to be finishing it now, and she waved the others over without looking up.
I think I have something.
Where's Danny? She could be helping you with this, said Damon.
Imani shook her head distractedly.
She's with her twins, and still recovering from her trip to the Doat.
She looked up now, focusing on him for just a second to add meaningfully,
and her return from said trip.
Danny Cage, called Danny by her friends, was a powerful witch herself, a known healer and none other than the daughter of a pair of honest-to-goodness gods. She and Lalura Chantel had recently ventured into the Doat, the Egyptian realm of the dead, to locate Danny's father, the god Amon, and get a leg up on why the kings and their queens were under attack by Amon's brother, Cayman. But they'd returned from their mysterious foray into that forbidden land to find their home on fire and their family and friends under fierce attack. The outcome of the battle against an army of rogue vampires had been devastating. There had been losses, horrible ones. Fortunately, warlocks were capable of bringing the dead back to life, and this is exactly what Jason Alberic and several other experienced warlocks had done, with the help of Diana Croy, Danny, and as many magic users as could be spared. In the end, every life had been safely returned to its mortal vessel. But the cost was extreme, and convalescing naturally needed to take place. The werewolf nation was in a state of stunned disbelief and wary confusion. Few could comprehend why the attack had taken place, or what Cayman or Raphael D'Angelo could possibly have hoped to accomplish by making enemies of the werewolves. Many, Roman included, had begun to believe the vampires were in fact working under a different leader, perhaps a former hunter. No one knew. And that was the point. There was a lot to figure out. And Danny, in particular, had a lot to figure out. She'd been mum on the subject of her trip into the Duat. She simply hadn't wanted to talk about it. When Lalura was questioned about what they'd seen, the old witch shook her head and stated,
"In time, Danny will share. She is not ready, and this story is not mine to tell."
Imani looked back down at the table and gestured to the bowl of water.
"Keep your eye on the image. Something is coming."
Everyone around the table leaned in a little. Collectively, they held their breaths. The bowl, not an average piece of dinnerware, was constructed of solid quartz crystal and reflected rainbow colors from the window light at varying angles. The water inside was pure and clear, nearly appearing invisible. But as the room's inhabitants looked on, the water began to mist up. Clouds formed like vapor, slowly billowing to fill the bowl's contents. Little by little, those clouds took up a turning motion, swirling within its shallow depths, and then darkening like a building storm. As the water went from clear to white to gray to black, an image blurred to life at the bowl's center. It appeared as if upon a movie screen, three-dimensional and out of reach. Roman frowned.
"What exactly did you ask?"
"The question must always be vague," said Imani. "However, I directed the magic to the traitor king."
The image was one of fire, its flames flickering and all-encompassing. They could almost hear the roar and crackle, and Roman could swear the air above the bowl was heating up. He thought of the men who occupied the 13 seats around his table and shook his head.
"There is no fire king."
"There is more than fire in the image,"
said Lalura softly.
"Look again."
Her bony finger rose from the depths of her cowl-like sleeve and pointed to something that was just now forming within the flames. Roman waited, his gaze narrowing, his focus sharpening.
"What is that?" someone asked.
"It looks like..."
Siobhan leaned in too, screwing up her face as she attempted to make heads or tails of what the image was showing them. From one angle, it resembled a smashed tin can, but from another, gems could be seen shattering amongst the metal rubble, and the metal itself had a very fine gleam to it.
"Like a crown, maybe, one that's been crushed."
"And burned," added Thane. "It's been crushed and burned."
He shrugged.
"It's a dead crown."
"A dead king?"
asked Imani, at last looking up to give them all a questioning gaze. One by one they returned the look, but none of them spoke. The week had been a harsh one for revelations concerning the kings. If what Imani was deciphering from the image was correct, then one of them was a traitor, and one of them would soon be dead. Were the two one and the same, or were the 13 about to become the 11?
Chapter 14. She floated in a broom, as if she were caught in a jar of thick, sparkling water. She saw her hair, white as snow, pass like a mermaid's mane before her dark, dark eyes. She heard voices in that muffled sing-song manner that one heard sounds in dreams. Here, in this fourth dimension, there were rainbow colors and there was warmth. There was no pain, neither physical nor mental. Time had passed, and she didn't even think to wonder how much. There was no time here, in fact. There was only this wraparound, multicolored calm that cocooned her and stretched into the horizon, as far as her unconscious eyes could see. At long last, Minerva was at peace. There were no regrets, and there was no sense of loss. In fact, she was not fully even self-aware. For one like Minerva, this was the single path to serenity. For awareness at all came with its own kind of pain. Here, finally, she was free from the shackles of corporeal existence, and it was unlike anything anyone had ever attempted to describe. Days swept by, or perhaps years or minutes, and she smiled in that floating, strings-cut vapor of tranquility. Until she wasn't smiling, and the fog was lifting, and she was opening her eyes. Lights from candles and sconces and what looked like floating balls of fairy fire ebbed their gentle way into her vision, outlining a vast, luxurious room of epic royal proportions. She was lying in a four-poster bed large enough for 10 adults. Silken sheets and blankets of dark colors that blended in ombre, some shimmering, as if they were encrusted with minuscule, glitter-sized gemstones, were draped across the bed and had wrapped around her legs as she'd moved restlessly in sleep. She blinked, attempting to remember where the hell she was. This was unfamiliar to her, but the last few days felt like a blur of photographs, like one dream that melted into another. She could just be forgetting. It was disconcerting to wake up and not know where you were, to not be able to remember how you got there. For a few strange seconds she existed there, in that foggy, frightening uncertainty. And then it all came back. At once Minerva sat up in the bed. Her breath caught in her chest when she smelled the familiar scent of the king's cologne. It was in the sheets. This was his bed. Awareness moved through her like a tidal wave of fire-heated blood, tightening her chest and widening her eyes. This was his chamber.
Oh, my God!
In his castle.
Oh, my God!
She said again, her voice cracking. Her throat was dry. Across the room, the double doors to the chamber at once came open, swinging outward with regal leisure. Feeling like a deer in headlights, Minerva clutched the blankets to her chest. Not even caring that she currently resembled some helpless maiden in a historical bodice-ripper. A small girl appeared between the double doors, no taller than 3 feet. Her slender arms were raised between the doors, but her palms didn't seem to be making contact with them.
Instead, there was a space of white light between them and her outstretched hands. She lowered her arms and looked up at Minerva, smiling broadly. She was dressed in a small but intricate and extremely fine gown that reminded Minerva of a miniature version of the gown the Buttercup had worn to her ill-fated wedding with Prince Humperdinck in The Princess Bride. The girl had very fair skin, extremely large pink-purple eyes, and a small mouth with perfect white teeth. She also sported very long and very thick hair, the color of a cloudless sky. It trailed all the way to her knees in braids and thick, sparkling locks, as if tinsel had been meticulously woven into it. Long, pointed ears peeked delicately between these locks, adding to the waif-like sense of the girl. Once the doors were open, the girl came inside the chamber and curtsied.
"My lady,"
she said softly, speaking with a beautiful voice that reminded Minerva of wind chimes.
"I've brought you nourishment. Lord Caliban wishes that you would eat and drink until you are comfortable, and then I will help you dress."
Minerva's brow rose.
"Oh?"
Though she was extremely taken with the girl, woman, elf, whatever, she had never in her life been one who catered to being given orders, even if those orders were phrased as wishes. Suddenly, quite unexpectedly, this massive chamber with its royal accoutrements felt a little too much like a gold-gilded prison. She shoved the covers aside and extracted herself from the bed. Her body instantly regretted it. The bed was warm and soft, and she felt tired, stiff, and sore. But she blinked, straightened her shoulders, and focused on the elf girl.
"What's your name?"
she asked plainly, trying not to allow too much of her irritation or discomfort to enter her tone. The girl looked a little surprised at first, but then she too straightened and cocked her head to one side.
"Well, the fates may just be right about you. You're certainly not like the other women he's had in here."
Now it was Minerva's turn to look surprised. Again. She opened her mouth to say something, but then shut it, because quite frankly, she could think of nothing to say to that. She felt her hands go to her waist, where her nails then began clenching, leaving half-moon imprints in the skin on her hips.
"Wait," she told herself firmly, "just hold up. Why do I flipping care?"
She closed her eyes a moment, forced her arms down at her sides, and took a deep breath.
Why was this bothering her?
She opened her eyes and said,
"You didn't tell me your name." "It's Titania,"
said the girl lightly, smiling brightly again.
"And you're Minerva."
She put her hands behind her back and eased onto her heels, very pleased with herself.
"Of course that's not your fey name. I know that name too, but don't worry, I won't tell anyone."
Minerva felt her legs go a little numb. A bunch of the knowledge that had slammed into her in Oxford came whittling back to her, buffeting her consciousness with its plethora of factoids. She tried to absorb it as best she could, feeling relieved when it at last settled down a bit and filtered for her just the information she needed.
"You're a fairy,"
she breathed. The thing about the fae is that the term fae was more or less short for fairy. However, among the fae, there were various kinds of fairy folk. One of the most special, the most wonderful, in fact, was the fairy. It was from fairies that fairy tales originated. The dreams of pixies and sprites and Tinkerbell-like imps flitting about on butterfly wings made their ways into children's imaginations across the globe. Fairies were exceptionally special creatures. The rather diminutive beings were always childlike. They remained this way throughout their entire existences, which, as of yet, had to be marked by time. They were simply considered immortal, incapable of dying a natural death. But the most special aspect to fairies was their ability to divine a fae's real name, and never tell another living soul. They simply wouldn't. They would die first. They would undergo torture. They would lose family members and all of their possessions and body parts, but they never, ever, ever revealed a fae's true name. Their minds could not be read. There was no use in trying.
Eventually it was determined that they were simply as incapable of sharing the information as they were capable of learning it. Now no one bothered even attempting to get names from them any longer. It was truly pointless. The fairy grinned proudly.
That I am.
She came further into the room and made her way to a small, ornately carved table not far from the bed. Minerva watched her in stunned silence as she waved her little hand over the table, and food and drink appeared atop it. There was even pastel-layered rainbow cake. Fairies were capable of a great many magical feats, some more amazing than others, such as that name-reading ability. But most useful to the fae around them was their ability to know an individual's personality, tastes, and dislikes. It was this ability that made fairies excellent personal assistants, handmaidens, and so forth. And these were positions the fairies took to with genuine glee, as it was in a fairy's nature to want to please those around it. Minerva could empathize with this. She had the same desire more often than not. Any time she'd had to attend a party for her school or co-workers, she'd spent incredible amounts of energy attempting to read the other attendants well enough to determine what they would want her to do or say. And then she'd done or said those exact things, just to fit in, just to be liked. The sudden memory made Minerva feel inexplicably and deeply sad. It felt like she'd lost parts of herself in all of that pretending, parts that she would never be able to get back again. The fairy looked up.
"Now, now," she said softly. "Come get some food and drink, my lady. You'll feel much better once you do."
Minerva hugged herself as a chill engulfed her. Maybe Titania was right. Maybe she needed some food. She did feel hungry. But what she really wanted was a
cup of tea, my lady.
Titania turned away from the small table she'd been filling with food. In her hands was a delicate, beautifully painted porcelain cup and saucer. In the cup was a steaming brew of what looked like perfectly milked and sweetened tea. Minerva could even smell it.
"Okay, you're really good at this,"
she said as she quickly approached the fairy and smiled a smile that was 100% real gratitude. It was nice to smile for real for once. Titania placed the cup and saucer in Minerva's hands.
"Why, thank you,"
she said in her tinkling chime voice.
"Now drink up. You've got a chill in you. I could see that much even from across the room."
Minerva took a sip and felt the warm, creamy liquid heat her up from the inside as it slid down her throat and into her belly. It was marvelous. It was exactly what she needed. But something niggled at her. She took another 3 rather greedy gulps and then replaced the teacup in its saucer.
"Titania?" "Yes, my lady?"
asked the fairy, as she finished making the table look exorbitantly beautiful with its mass of food. She regarded Minerva and waited.
"Why do you keep calling me that?"
"Calling you what, my lady?"
"That, my lady. Why do you keep referring to me like that?"
Titania blinked before she smiled what looked like an older, wiser smile, especially on a face as apparently young as hers.
"Why, I know your true name, my lady. I know what it means. And so I know you are the future queen of the Unseelie Kingdom."
Chapter 15 Minerva moved from one bookshelf to the other, and as she stood at the foot of each one, she craned her neck and looked up, and up, and up.
"This is ridiculous,"
she muttered, running her hand over her face in bewilderment. She was so lost. She hadn't been able to keep up with the twists and turns at the palace as Titania had walked her here. The castle was so vast it was impossible. The gods only knew where the nearest bathroom was, should she need it. To top it off, the library itself, a tiny portion of the castle, was a maze of preposterous proportions in and of itself. She dropped her hand and turned around in the room, taking it all in. The Unseelie Castle Library was a parody of large libraries. She felt a little bit like Belle from Disney's Beauty and the Beast, gazing up at the plethora of spines with their unreadable titles,
gilded in gold and other precious metals. There were even ladders. There were 12 of them, in fact, just in this room alone. The library was actually composed of a large number of rooms, all of them several stories high, and Miniver had yet to explore but two of them. The first had comprised of a wondrous double-door entrance. It opened onto a foyer where bits of all of the rooms could be seen, like an endless mansion of magnificent literature that curved off into the distance and went as far as the eye could see. The lighting was provided by pendant chandeliers that hung from a ceiling so high above, Minerva would wager it was at least 5 stories high. The chandeliers dangled from ropes of what looked like spider's silk, thin and shimmery. Ever-burning fey candles shed rainbow light and lent a soft yellow glow that was then prismed through endless crystal shards that hung from the pendants, lengthy and lean, some as much as 2 feet long. Plush seating arrangements awaited weary bodies and open minds, and bookstands waited, with attached bookmarks, for any larger tomes that one might not wish to hold in their lap. The second room was much the same, sporting the same marble flooring shot through with bits of gemstone and gold, walls of books and soft warm lighting. Minerva decided to move on into the third, and give up on figuring out what the actual books on the shelves comprised. Most likely they were in a language she wouldn't comprehend anyway. Of course, she could always wish to comprehend them. No, it doesn't work that way, she reminded herself. A wish acts in vengeance, remember? I can only cast wishes in anger, she thought as she moved quickly through the second room toward the third room's arched entry. An odd, lonely feeling moved through her, and she hugged herself.
Maybe that's not true,
she whispered, attempting to console herself out loud. But it didn't help much, and her pace slowed with an oncoming sense of exhaustion. She had already been on edge. She'd come here to the library to try to think, to have some time to herself, to clear her head and get some things straight. If Titania was right and she was supposed to be the queen of the Unseelie realm, then, well, that would explain a few things, like why Caliban had been shadowing her and shielding her. She'd been rather confused about that. It probably wasn't that he had anything personally invested in her. It was just that he'd be really embarrassed if he lost his queen before she'd even taken her throne. What kind of rumors would be spread about him then? The king who couldn't keep a fated queen? Minerva sighed. She could be flippant about it all she wanted, but it was a lot to take in. And something else bothered her, too, something else Titania had said. It was something about Minerva being different from the other women Caliban had taken to his bed. Minerva winced in pain. Ow! She whispered, coming to an abrupt halt beneath the archway to the third library room. She'd unconsciously bitten a hole in her bottom lip.
Holy shit! She hissed.
A flood of emotions rushed through her veins, heating them up. She brushed the back of her hand angrily across her lips, and it came away with blood.
Damn!
She lowered her hand and looked around for a box of tissue.
Stupid! She chastised herself. Fey castles don't just leave tissue boxes laying around.
Minerva froze and blinked when she spotted the exact thing on a table in the third room, waiting amongst a sea of fresh-baked goods, hot tea, and what smelled and looked like cocoa. The third room was much like the first and second, sporting walls that were shelves full of books, soft, cushiony chairs and couches, and lighting that was luxurious and perfect. The only difference was that here, a warm fire burned in a hearth against one wall, and a large coffee table had been set with food and drinks. She could tell it was all fresh, because she could smell it. The scent of cookies and bread straight from the oven wafted toward her, and she could see steam rising from the teapot. And amidst all of this, as innocently placed as can be, sat a waiting box of Kleenex. Minerva frowned at the table. She'd thought she was alone in the library.
Titania had assured her it was a private, quiet place, and she hadn't seen anyone coming or going since she'd arrived, so where had the fresh food come from? And how the hell did they know to give her a box of tissue? She hastened to the table to yank a fresh tissue from the box. It wiggled a little in its place, knocking against one of the teacups. Fortunately, the cup was empty, so nothing spilled, but it added to her aggravation. She placed the tissue gently to her bottom lip to soak up the blood she could feel welling there, then turned in place, her gaze searching the walls for a hidden doorway or evidence of a secret passageway.
"You won't find anyone else," came a deep voice.
Minerva went very still, shocked into motionless at the familiar sound of that magic-laced timbre. Then she spun around to face its source. Lord Caliban, King of the Unseelie Fae, strolled casually into the third library room, his hands in his suit pants pockets. He looked like he was coming straight from a meeting with shareholders. Not a hair was out of place. He was perfectly shaved, and she caught a whiff of some very expensive, very delicious cologne.
"Other than me, that is," he added with a smile.
Minerva's mouth began to water, and that irritated the crap out of her, not only because it made her feel that she was fate's plaything, falling right into the path someone else had chosen for her, but because she couldn't get Titania's other words out of her head. Just like he couldn't seem to keep other women out of his bed.
"You're bleeding,"
he said suddenly, coming to a halt a few feet away. His eyes cut to her lip, and Minerva noticed their centers glowed as if on fire. Butterflies came to life in her belly.
"Are you well?"
he asked softly. Too softly. She shrugged.
"What do you care?"
she asked. She instantly regretted it. She closed her eyes and took a quick, deep breath.
"I'm sorry, yes, I'm fine."
She shook her head.
"I just bit my lip."
She removed the tissue from her mouth and crumpled it up in a tight fist. It gave her something else to focus on, which was good because suddenly the endlessly vast library felt a little small. The Unseelie King watched her in silence for a moment, his expression cold but his eyes burning in stark contrast. His demeanor was calculating and careful. It was wholly unnerving.
"Titania told me I would find you here,"
he said, in that careful tone that suggested he was striding with great vigilance into conversation with her. Minerva glanced around them at the library and threw up her hands.
"It's some library,"
she said helplessly.
"Have you actually read any of these?"
"All of them."
Minerva gawked.
"All of them?"
she asked. Her voice croaked a little, coming out in a half-whisper. The Unseelie King looked down at the floor as he appeared to contemplate something. He moved further into the room, and his gaze traveled along the shelves. After a few seconds, he stopped before one particular section, raised his hand, and brushed his fingers along a book's spine.
"A book is a journey,"
he said, pulling the book from the shelf and gazing at the front cover.
"Each word is a step that carries a reader from start to finish, not unlike a living being. Long or short, they are the same in one manner. They have a beginning and an end."
He looked up now and strode slowly toward her.
"Even so, I prefer the company of books."
Minerva said nothing. He was coming closer, and all she could think about was how beautiful he was. Tall, dark, and handsome. It was the trifecta of death for any single woman's will. Add indomitable power and insanely hypnotic magic to the mix, and you would have Caliban.
"But for the occasional exception, books never betray you. They never leave you."
He smiled wryly at her.
"And they will never attempt to kill you."
He stopped directly in front of her, and without breaking eye contact, absently tossed the book in his hand to the nearest table, where she saw it land safely and square in the middle. A thousand fractured thoughts flashed their fragmented way through her mind. Without meaning to do it, and before she could fully realize she was even speaking, she said,
"Titania told me that my fey name means I'm supposed to be queen of the Unseelie Kingdom."
The statement felt like a shockwave. She was stunned in disbelief at her own words, her breath stilled in her lungs, freezing on the inside and refusing to budge. Her heart, however, ironically pumped faster. So very fast. She could hear it pounding away in her eardrums. Caliban gazed steadily down at her, his expression inscrutable. His eyes so close that she could now see there were actual flames flickering away at their centers. They were mesmerizing, all-encompassing, horribly hypnotic.
"How does that make you feel, Minerva?"
His words wrapped around her, his voice as hypnotic as his gaze. She made a sound, but when she realized it was incoherent, she tried again.
How does it make you feel?
That was what she wanted to know, wasn't it? She wanted to know how he felt. She didn't know why. She barely knew him, but he'd gotten under her skin over the last few days, and though she was loath to admit it, she wanted him to want her. Just like the song said. The corners of his mouth curled up.
"I would have thought my feelings had been made very clear by now."
Minerva's head swam, but she was still with it enough to recognize that what he had just said was patently false. If anything, none of his intentions whatsoever had been made clear, beyond the necessity to stay alive while under attack by some unknown assailant. Nothing they'd done possessed any definite direction or plan.
"No,"
she forced herself to say. Her voice sounded far off to her own ears.
"Not at all."
That curve in the corner of Caliban's lips turned up even more, and the flames at the centers of his eyes leapt.
"Then I've been terribly remiss. Allow me to remedy the situation and show you exactly how it makes me feel."
There was no space to take a breath, no time to fully register what he'd just said, before his power encompassed her like a cocoon. At once it was clear he'd been holding it back from her, sparing her from its incredible intensity all this time. Her eyes closed, her body swooned, and strong arms snaked around her like iron bands. His kiss came swift and sure as he claimed her mouth with his, and her legs gave out beneath her. His skill was adept. He pushed and she gave, he applied pressure and she opened for him, and he kissed her deep and long, sending her floating into a sweet oblivion that would forever ruin her for any other kisser in the realms. Chapter 16. Heat snaked up from Minerva's belly and spread outward. Caliban's grip on her tightened, ironclad and desperate. His body was hard against hers, a steel wall, unyielding and capable, and Minerva was a rag doll in his unforgiving embrace. It felt like surrender, that kiss. It felt like she was giving up, giving in, and accepting something for once. It should have infuriated her, but it felt wonderful. His lips on hers, his arms holding her close, his fingers spreading across her flesh, curling into her and claiming her, all terrible and magical and all too powerfully charming. But they were also perfect. Perfect. Her mind swam in a kind of bliss she knew was only a taste of what the Unseelie King could offer her. He was only teasing her, breaking her down, promising her that there was more, so much more, where this came from, and he intended to give her all of it. Perfect. Wait. Her thoughts hitched. This was too perfect. Minerva knew better. Life wasn't the type of thing to hand anyone anything perfect. There was always a price to pay. There was always some balancing monstrosity. Nature had no regard for wisdom or kindness. Not a single thing in the world could live without destroying some other living thing. Life was a douchebag. So there had to be a catch. With tremendous will, Minerva placed her hands against the brick wall of Caliban's chest and pressed firmly. Either he didn't notice or he chose to ignore her. The kiss went on, rocking her to her core, melting her beneath him. It almost silenced her inner voice, but that damn thing prevailed, wailing at the tops of its little lungs. Minerva summoned even more will, and this time she shoved with everything she had. Caliban budged this time, however obviously doing so only of his own free will. He slowly pulled away enough to release her from his kiss. It was devastating to be set free, like waking far too soon from a really hot dream. It took her a moment to gather her senses and open her eyes. Thankfully, he continued to hold her, his arms a firm band of support against her back, because her legs still felt like jelly beneath her, wobbly and utterly insufficient as support beams for a human being. "What's—" she began breathlessly, but ran out of air. She swallowed, took another few shaking breaths, and said, "What's the catch?" Caliban gazed down at her through eyes that possessed irises of pure fire. Any hint of amethyst color or green flecks had vanished beneath a conflagration of out-of-control heat. It scared her. She was getting used to the surprising nature of magic, and she'd seen a hint of those flames in his eyes before, but now he just looked plain deadly. If he wanted, he could incinerate her with no more than a thought. "The catch?" he demanded softly. His voice was so low it was almost a growl, and Minerva's wariness ratcheted up a notch. She didn't know what to say, didn't know how to explain her skepticism, her admittedly jaded but wholly realistic view of the world. And the way he was looking at her stole the rest of her words and held them hostage. Very slowly Caliban pulled further away, his arms slipping from around her waist. Minerva steadied herself on wobbly legs, grateful to find they held. "I see," he said, the growl seeping slowly from his voice, to be replaced with something that sounded a little more reasonable. The flames in his eyes retreated, revealing bits of bright, sparkling purple and glowing green. "You don't trust me."
It's not you I don't trust."
"Oh my God, yes it is," her thoughts interjected. But she pushed on.
"I don't trust this."
She gestured to the library around her and all of its impossible magnificence. But her gaze traveled beyond the library, far off and wonder-filled, to encompass the whole of the Fey realms.
"I don't understand it. It's all too much."
She was reeling from everything that had been sprung on her in the last few days, the last few hours of her life, and her body was still reeling from his kiss. A part of her wondered whether she was really handling everything as well as she thought she was.
"I'm not sure I'm ready for this,"
she whispered, turning away from him because it was easier to think with him at her back.
"I barely believe it."
There was a long silence before Minerva heard Caliban's leather-soled shoes move away from her. She turned around to find him before the coffee table filled with food. He was lifting a decanter from its surface and pouring a light blue liquid into a crystal glass. He filled it nearly to the brim, then downed half its contents in one swift drink. She watched as he refilled it almost to the top once more and took another long drink, this time emptying the glass. He gritted his teeth and stared down at his glass for a moment, as if deciding whether or not to have more. Finally, he set the glass down with a rather hard thunk, and picked up the decanter to refill it after all.
"What can I do to help you accept this, Minerva?"
he asked, as he recorked the decanter and lifted the glass. The way he spoke gave her a chill. His tone was smooth but icy, impatient yet calm. It was a dichotomy of things that left her uneasy. His eyes had nearly returned to their normal purple and green, but for a small flickering flame that remained lodged firmly in their irises, burning away. He seemed taller now than he had before, if that was even possible, and the contrasts of him were more stark. He was the Leonan king, a beautiful, deadly enigma, and she was treading water with a shark. She should have been scared. So why wasn't she?
I don't know,
she said honestly, willing her legs to strengthen beneath her.
What if...
She paused briefly before words forced themselves up and out of her mouth, and she was powerless to stop them.
What if I don't want to accept it?
And that was the crux of it, right there. She hadn't even realized it until she'd given it voice. Her gaze trailed off as her thoughts took over. She was being handed something that every other woman in the world dreamed about their entire lives, read books about, and would fantasize about. But she wasn't sure she wanted it. She didn't want it because she was being handed it. She couldn't stand the idea of following someone else's rules or accepting her place in the scheme of things. She had never been a sheep. Fate assumed she would just go with it, and because she had never been the kind of person who rolled over and let things happen, she was bucking. Hard. There was that. That knee-jerk reaction to being bossed around by life. There was that. And... there was the fact that the Unseelie King was a playboy who had probably had countless women, and who maybe he didn't even fully plan to settle down after he took his queen. Maybe he was going to keep sleeping around. Some kings had harems, right? They had courtesans, and God only knew what else. If that kiss was any indication, he'd had loads of practice, and then some. She'd be damned if she was going to be a notch in his very large bedpost. Minerva came out of her revelatory, somewhat heated thoughts when she realized the air in the room had grown heavy. It was stifling and thick and hard to breathe. She looked up in time to see the fire in the hearth across the room snuff itself out. Slow curls of smoke rose from the logs inside. She spun at the sound of something cracking behind her, and looked to the windows to watch a hair-like fracture spiderweb itself across two of the panes. The temperature in the room was dropping. There was pressure, too. She felt it press in on her skin, her eyes, everything. It was subtle now, but held a threat of becoming much worse very quickly. She turned back to face the Unseelie King. Caliban stood motionless beside the table, one hand poised around his glass, the other in his pocket. His eyes were hard and cold.
"I think you'll find that ultimately you have no choice in the matter, Moonbeam," he said icily. He took a step toward her. "You may decide to fight, and you can even run, but eventually your fate will catch up with you."
He took a drink from his glass, this one not quite as large as the two before it, and continued to come toward her. She felt his power brush against her like dry ice or frozen fire. It burned, and yet it was warm, and, damned it all, like a born masochist, she wanted more.
"As will I,"
he added before emptying the glass for the third time. He stopped before her and lowered it to his side just before it shimmered in his grip to disappear altogether. He then slid his now free hand into his other pocket and squared her with a gaze of sheer intensity.
"So I will ask you again, and I suggest you give the question some real thought. What can I do to help you accept this and take your place as my queen?"
Chapter 17. Minerva stared up into those purple-green depths, and knew good and well that he wasn't just offering to help her. He was giving her an ultimatum. What surprised her was that her heart was pounding, but not in fear, not even close. The room felt as though it would implode and take both of them down with her, and yet she was still writhing in fate's grip, fighting like a prize fish on a reeled-in line. With slow deliberation, Minerva crossed her arms over her chest. She even narrowed her gaze.
"Well, for one thing,"
she said, shocked beyond belief that she was speaking firmly and clearly, with not a hint of tremor to her words.
"You can tell me why the hell you would even care about gaining a queen."
She was on a runaway train now. She'd been feeling this burning in her gut ever since she'd awoken.